prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror movies, specifically those which have fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
I'm Lance.
And this episode, we are diving into our very first TV movie that we've covered on the podcast.
Yes, very exciting.
Yes. We are going to be talking about Fear No Evil, which aired originally on March 3rd, 1969, as part of the NBC Monday Night at the Movies series. And joining us for this, there is no better person to discuss a TV movie than Amanda Reyes. Welcome, Amanda.
Oh, gosh. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk about this movie.
Amanda is the author and editor of Are You in the House Alone? Growing Up with Gargoyles, Giant Turtles, Valerie Harper, The Cold War, Stephen King, and Coed Call Girls, a TV movie compendium 1964 to 1999 that was put out by Head Press. She's a Rondo-nominated film commentator. You can find her on lots of Kino releases, mostly for TV movies, but also plenty of slashers, and we'll get into a few recommendations for commentaries later on. So basically, anytime the TV movies come up, you're going to hear Amanda's name come up in conversation. Like I mentioned, this is our first TV movie that we've covered. So I do kind of want to level set a little bit here for our audience and maybe provide some context for our listeners about TV movies. So I just, you know, I had a few questions for you just to kind of get us in the TV movie mood here. So
Okay. You
had brought up Elaine Rapping's book, the TV movie of the week, Private Stories, Public Events. I believe either in your interview with Bill on supporting characters, which everyone should listen to that in every one of his episodes because Bill is wonderful.
Yes.
Or it could have been at your lecture at Final Girls Berlin or both, but it's also listed on your blog on your list of recommended reading. So I recently bought this and I hope that you could expand on one of the things that she says in her preface, and she opens up the whole book by saying, when it comes to made for TV movies, people seem to fall into two distinct categories, those who love them and those who hate them. The latter category is far more vocal and therefore more visible. It is almost de rigueur for TV critics in daily newspapers to dismiss TV movies as trashy, sentimental, sensationalized, tearjerkers plagued with everything from wooden acting to poor production values. Those who disagree are seldom heard from for obvious reasons. The verdict in the middle and highbrow circles has been so uniformly negative that it takes a certain amount of nerve to dispute it publicly. So you're clearly one of the most vocal advocates for these films. Can you just kind of talk briefly about what it is about these films that you love?
Yeah. You know, I guess it goes back to just being a kid and watching movies like Gargoyles and Don't Be Afraid of the Dark on the local channel as a kid, because they seemed like a gateway into horror for me and they seemed appropriate for my parents. Although I will tell you, I caught my parents watch. I didn't catch them. I came home from school one day and my parents were watching Trilogy of Terror, and I just happened to come in the final segment with the Zuni fetish doll. And I was like 8 and I was getting a bologna sandwich or whatever and going to go back out and play. And then I was hypnotized by this film that terrified me and traumatized me for forever. But because it was made for TV, my parents were like, oh, she can watch it. And so TV movies were always like a gateway into genre films for me. But as I got older and I started watching the other kinds of movies, I found that I don't think there's anything wrong with melodrama, and I will defend melodrama till my dying day. I think it serves a very important purpose, which Elaine Rapping goes into. The whole kind of thesis of her book is that melodrama speaks to women and TV movies are telling women's stories. And this movie, I think, is a good example of how it does it. And so I found that I was really drawn to a lot of other types of films that were made for television. And also there's a sense of comfort to them because they tended to have casts of very familiar faces. And so there's something about sitting down to watch a TV movie because they do have kind of a defined blueprint, but they're also doing some kind of interesting subversions in that blueprint. and especially in the genre film. And Elaine Rapping is probably the queen of all things. The thing about her book that's really interesting is that the first half of it is really heavily steeped in theory. Mm-hmm. And so you have to really want to listen to like Baudelaire or whatever, you know, Lacan, and she throws out all these names and it gets really heavy. But the second half of the book, she talks a lot about movies like My Mother's Secret Life, which is a TV movie with Lonnie Anderson, where she's a high-priced escort, very classy escort, who has this teenage daughter she hasn't seen since she was little, and all of a sudden has to become her mother again. And that's one of those like, oh, this is such a made-for-TV movie. But she talks about the liberatory aspects of the film, including the fact that that she's in charge of her own body and the choices that she makes to be a call girl are her own, and that sexuality is something that she's comfortable with. And these are all things that women were seeing when they were watching these movies and maybe relating to it on some degree. Like we're not all sitting there going, I want to be a high priced call girl. But right. Like we understand that the subtext is actually about women being in charge of their own destinies and their own bodies and stuff. And so, and Elaine Rapping makes these points throughout her book, and it's really amazing. And it opened up a doorway for me in a lot of different ways. But I think this is a long answer, but I think in general, it's just that I was allowed to watch these movies growing up, and they were the gateway into genre films for me, basically. And then later, after I started kind of revisiting these films, I started branching out and I saw that so many of these movies are so well made. And I loved that they were made for women, mostly. Of course, something like The Night Stalker might not be, but I would say the bulk of these TV movies that were being produced up until the late 90s were made for me. And they were saying things to me that I really related to and appreciated. And no other venue is doing that anywhere. And I think that's why they became so important to me.
That's great. Yeah. So My Mother's Secret Life, just kind of circling back to that, you know, the way that her sexuality is presented, but then the way that the film actually ends with her kind of leaving that life, getting married, there seems to still be, you know, besides having this like control over your own body and sexuality and sort of thing, there seem to be some other types of coded messages in there. Can you talk kind of about that and how that relates to the target audience for these movies?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. One thing that Elaine Rapping talks about is that by the end of the film, the family should always be stronger. And that it is going to have these kind of, she doesn't use the word vanilla, but it's going to have these kind of vanilla endings. And it's interesting because when I wrote my book, which is called Are You in the House Alone? A TV Movie Compendium, 1964 to 1999, I reviewed, so Wes Craven made 4 made-for-TV movies, but I reviewed 3 of them because they all were kind of connected by this idea of remarking on the cultural landscape that he was seeing around him in the 80s and the late 70s. So he did 3 TV movies, which was Summer of Fear, Invitation to Hell, and my favorite, which is called Chiller, which came out in the mid-80s. And they all kind of have this pat ending where everything is kind of resolved at the end. And I think it is intriguing. It's like Harlequin. It's like, if you read a Harlequin, and I love Harlequin and I love all those romances. If you read a Harlequin romance novel, the woman always has this like very strong component. A lot of times she's a business owner or she's very autonomous. And then she meets somebody and they go through their rigmarole. And then she always ends up kind of giving up the business or whatever and gets married. And that's complicated because it is kind of sending these mixed messages. And I feel like that has to be there because network television has to placate millions and millions of people. And so they can't just have like total subversion throughout a film and then expect audiences to just eat it up because we were being fed other messages from other places. And so they had to figure out how to kind of wrap these things up. But I think it's okay to have mixed messages in films because if you realize that they're mixed messages, that means that you're thinking about them and you can kind of make a judgment yourself what that means and how it applies to you. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with deciding to get married and deciding to give up whatever life you had before. But at the same time, you know, that message is still in there that like up until this point, she was showing a lot of independence. And sometimes they are able to subvert that more so in the genre film, I would say. But I think, yeah, I think you're right. It's clear that those mixed messages are there. I think for me, it's about the interacting with the messages that's really important. And so when I lecture on these films, I guess I try to bring up what I find to be the subversive subtext so that people can see that they're not just trying to like veer you to one, this kind of Americana way of living, that there are, they're implanting these ideas that there is options for women in this world. And they have had, so I watched this movie called The Love Tapes with Loretta Swit. And I'm trying to remember the rest of the cast now. And it's amazing. It came out, I think, in the late 70s, early 80s. And it was about these different people who were using this video dating service, which was very popular at the time, to meet people. And it's kind of a comedy. And it's falling off that kind of Love Boat, like where they're showing different stories, kind of anthologized in a way, with like The Love Tapes or the video dating service sort of being the connector. And Loretta Swit, who is a goddess, is playing this single woman who's looking for somebody because she's got this kid who's like 8 and he's a handful and she loves him, but it's really hard to like have a job and be a mom and not have anybody to support that. And so she meets this guy and he comes along and he loves kids. I think he might even be a school teacher or something. And he's constantly taking them out, but all the dates involve the kid because he's so enamored with children. And she has to make this decision about what to do with this. And she realizes that what she's looking for is not this. She wants somebody who loves her with or without children. And she ends up breaking, and I'm going to spoil this, sorry, but she ends up breaking up. Yeah, she ends up breaking up with him. And her son is confused by this because he loves this guy. And she has to explain to her kid, I have to do what's right for me. And what's right for me will be right for you too. And she ends up single at the end of it. And so while there are lots of movies where the family does get stronger, and then you could look at it that way, the family does get stronger because she puts herself first, which allows her to be a better mother, I think, and eventually a better wife when she meets the right person. And so there are all these different kind of things that are happening. I think Elaine Rapping is looking at, like, it would be impossible. There's over 5,000 made for TV movies. So it would kind of be impossible to sort of categorize them all without seeing all the little threads. So she has to take the bulk of what's happening. But essentially, yeah, I think they do give mixed messages, but I think if you're paying attention, you can learn a lot about people and about the cultural landscape and maybe a little bit about yourself if you kind of tune into what the films are doing.
I think along those same lines, just to bring up another one where the woman doesn't end up with the man, and it's another one that Rapping brought up in her book, was The Women's Room from 1980, starring Lee Remick, where, you know, this woman basically chooses academia over this like hunky, really great guy. So I think those messages are still in there, and they, like Amanda said, they don't all end up with like wife, husband, 2.5 kids, white picket fence kind of situation.
Yeah, there's a lot. Now I'm thinking of all the like examples, and I'll just be real brief, but there was a movie called Babies, and I'm not a big baby person, but this is a really cool movie about three women who are all seeking to have babies in different ways. And Lindsay Wagner, another goddess, plays this woman who is like a professor or something. And by the end of the movie, she makes the decision not to have a child because it's not right for her. And so, yeah, so you can see lots of like these different threads in the genre movie. I think a really good example might be something like, there's a movie called Night Terror with Valerie Harper. And that's actually about the progression of her as a person when she starts off as this very helpless, kind of like doofusy kind of housewife who ends up by the end of the movie becoming a really strong character. And there's two versions of the movie. And I think in the expanded, so it ran in a 73 minute time frame. Most TV movies in that era were much shorter. And to expand it to fit into a 2-hour programming block in reruns, they added footage. And I believe it's in the added footage version where she's talking to her husband and he's like, I can't believe I let you travel across the desert. After she's been chased by this guy and he has no idea what's happened to her. I can't believe I let you travel by yourself. I mean, you're not good at this kind of stuff. And he said, you're no Gloria Steinem. And she says, no, I'm not. Not yet. And that's kind of how the film ends. Mm. And it's this really powerful moment, you know, where she realizes her worth as a person and her strength. And that movie is actually a really good example of like, of charting sort of a woman's progress throughout second wave feminism and how they navigate it. And so these movies are doing really interesting things.
I just watched that one recently. I've been on a TV movie binge getting ready for this episode. So I've watched plenty before, but definitely just after watching your lecture at Final Girls and listening to Bill's episode, I definitely found a lot. That was one I really enjoyed. I even had a note about that one. I rewatched Nightmare in Bottom County with your commentary, which was
so
great.
Good.
And so I did want to kind of get back to that idea about those coded messages and the target audience. So one of the things you had brought up, there's, you know, very specific demographics for these at the time that they were coming out. initially it was women or housewives 18 to 49. And then later on that expanded to both men and women age 10 to 31, more for like horror movies sort of disguised as a thriller. Your book focuses on the sort of heyday of TV movies from 1964 to 1999. So do you think that the audience for these has changed since they were originally aired, now that some of them are starting to get releases and a lot more people are kind of circling back to them now as people who were children or maybe weren't even alive when these came out originally?
Oh, do you think the audience is expanding?
Yeah.
For the retro vintage films.
Yeah,
you know, it's interesting. I don't know why this is, but most people who follow my social media are men. And that really surprised me because when I watch them, I just see like a lot of the feminist aspects that are kind of in there encoded. And I, to a degree, they see them too. And I'm not saying that they're all like incels or anything like that. It's just interesting that men are really into TV movies, and I hear less from women. And I don't know if that's the nature of social media. It might just be that men find it easier to approach me. I don't know. But I thought that was really interesting. And I have gotten a little pushback on it. Like I did a commentary for something and I won't go too into it, but they got really pissed off that I spent literally like 5 minutes of it talking about feminism. Yeah. But most of it has been male audiences who are really interested in these films. And I'm kind of surprised by that. So yeah, I definitely think it's grown. And I also think that most men probably like this idea of seeing something from a different perspective. You know, we talk a lot about in these days about representation. And I do think that despite what you see maybe on Twitter and stuff about people getting really put off by that, those are just really loud minority. You know, I feel like the majority of people are interested in seeing different perspectives and seeing movies made by Hispanics or women or, you know, Europeans or, you know, Black people. And so I think that we're more open than we give each other credit for. And so this is a really interesting kind of venue to see movies that are generally women's stories.
So kind of circling back again to something else you mentioned about TV movies being like a gateway to horror movies for you. You mentioned Gargoyles, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, Trilogy of Terror. What are some other gateway TV movies for folks who are just getting into the genre?
I would say the ultimate gateway made-for-TV horror movie, it's almost guaranteed to get people interested in made-for-TV movies, is Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. I can't imagine another movie that gets people excited and interested. It's such an interesting film, and it's good. It's really good. And it seems like people who might be dismissive of the made-for-TV movie can see that it does have a cinematic flair to it. It's got interesting stories to tell. It's scary. Now, these movies obviously aren't violent because of the nature of the restrictions that networks had to deal with, but they're really good at like suggesting violence and keeping you on the edge of your seat. Another movie, it's a classic too, that I think people really kind of enjoy. It's questionable, but it's fun, as Bad Ronald with Scott Jacoby, which is a really great movie, which I don't know. I feel like watching it with new audiences, it might be like, ooh, that's really creepy, but it's supposed to be, you know? And if anybody's read the novel, he's clearly not a nice person. He's much more sympathetic in the film. And you can question whether or not that's okay, appropriate to feel sympathy for this guy. But that's another movie people really like. I am a big fan of like underdog films. I really like to seek out little movies that people don't often talk about. I think a really good one, but it helps, I guess, to have context for it, might be something like The Victim, which Kino Lorber released, and I was lucky enough to do the commentary for. And that's an Elizabeth Montgomery film. Also, The Legend of Lizzie Borden is a classic. Anything with Elizabeth Montgomery is going to be great. But what I like about The Victim is all the things that I lecture on are kind of implanted in that film in very clear ways. And also, she's a powerhouse, and that's a really interesting film. There's two movies I put on the list here because David Levinson, who produced Fear No Evil, who was a co-producer, he would go on and he wrote a lot of TV movies too. And he did two of my favorites, which is This House Possessed and Fantasies. And they came out back to back. This House Possessed is my all-time favorite a made-for-TV movie, and people tend to like it. It's goofy. It's a little over the top. It doesn't always make sense, maybe, but it's really fun, and it's kind of bananas, and I find people kind of like that too. And there's another movie. I actually screened it here at the Alamo when I was doing those screenings for Terror Tuesday. It's called Crawl Space. It came out in 1972, and that's a movie that is really, I think, it's been more readily available than other TV movies, so luckily people have seen it. But it's a really bizarre film. And what I recognized, or realized, I should say, when I saw it with the crowd was that people weren't sure how to take it, because it's like one third domestic drama, one third kind of black comedy, and one third outright horror. Mm. And you're never quite sure if you should be laughing at what's happening or being like, oh my God, this is really intense and dark. And that's a really neat movie that somebody just contacted me because they saw it based on my recommendation and they were floored by it. And I was so grateful that they loved it, because I hate recommending movies and have people be like, that sucked, you know, but they really liked it. And so I think those are really good films to get people kind of interested in what made-for-TV horror has to offer.
Yeah. I think another good way to get folks interested is sometimes you have to build them a bridge of familiarity and say, you know, one that you watched, Lance, I think it was last year or the year before, and I just recently watched it for this, because you had described it as The Thing, as a TV movie, A Cold Night's Death.
A Cold Night's Death, yes.
I mean, if you can't sell a horror movie person on that, that description alone, and that movie pays off.
Yeah, that's an effectively scary, creepy TV movie. Yeah. That one and all the recommendations that Amanda just said are perfect. Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, I remember watching that as a kid. That was programmed for Terror Tuesday one year, and I was extremely excited. Same for Bad Ronald. Don't Go to Sleep is another one that just
That's right.
I love another Dennis Weaver.
That one, that movie's mean, and I like it for that. Yeah. You don't typically see, like, you know, like Amanda said, they're not graphic, but that movie kills three kids.
Yeah, your favorite.
It does, and it's also like really raw in how it expresses the grief of the daughter that dies. Like, there's some really amazing domestic drama moments in that as well. And I can't believe I didn't think of that, because that's such a perfect example of melding this idea of melodrama and horror. That's a really good film.
Yeah, I think another bridge to build for folks is, you know, you had mentioned familiar faces and saying like, oh, well, this person's in that movie. And I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, they'll look at Letterboxd and see certain actors and they'll look at, you know, their most popular films. But if you keep scrolling down, a lot of times you're going to find some TV movies that these people were in. And one that I found that I really liked and I just watched recently is called Deathstalk from 1975, starring Vic Morrow and Neville Brand. It's like The River Wild. Nice. Neville Brand is so effing creepy in this movie. It's fantastic. Deathstalk, I think it was on YouTube. I mean, a lot of these movies are on YouTube, and that's kind of another thing you've brought up in other discussions as well, Amanda, is that obviously, first and foremost, you want to support the movie if the film is available to buy. You want to support the people who made the film, who are putting in the effort to put these out. But a lot of these, they do end up on YouTube, and they usually are people who recorded it back in the day and uploaded it to YouTube. So some of them are available. But I think you mentioned a statistic that absolutely floored me. You had mentioned something like 5,000 TV movies, but you had said you estimated something like 90% of these are just lost.
Yeah, they're somewhere, you know, like in like Fear No Evil, I believe, was sitting in a Universal vault, if I'm correct, and nobody just thought anything of it. And then finally, Kino Lorber went in there and did the Lord's work, because it's one of the most beautifully shot things I can think of off the top of my head. And it's such a shame that it just was sitting there. So many of these movies are just gone or they're somewhere, but they're not available to the public. And it's interesting because there was a series that ran, I think, in the mid-70s or early to mid-70s called the ABC Wide World Mystery. And those were all shot on video. And I think most of them have disappeared, and they assume that they're gone because they were shot on videotape, or they were put on videotape and the videotapes were cleared for other stuff. But they say that, and a couple of them have come out. So there's this movie called Sorority Kill, which was like my golden chalice for like a decade. And it just popped up on YouTube one day.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, it re-ran on some channel somewhere, and somebody taped it, and they put it up on YouTube in like five chapters, and it's a really crappy upload with like all the, like, you know, TV gets staticky and stuff and got the lines. It's got all that, but it's, I can watch it. And I was so excited. And there's another one called Alien Lover that there's a, it actually reran on a cable channel. So I think somebody recently uploaded a really beautiful copy of it. And there's a 60 millimeter print of The Norming of Jack 241, I think is the title, which was directed by Gloria Monty, who was a producer on General Hospital. And it's one of the first appearances of Christopher Reeve in a film or TV thing. And it plays every so often at sci-fi conventions. And so it exists. So I have high hopes that they'll find more of these as time goes on. And the UCLA Television and Film Archive actually has a bunch of them. And every Halloween they've been airing one. And they've done three so far. And they're amazing.
Nice. For folks, we've thrown a lot of titles out there for you. Don't worry. I will put a letterbox list together for our listeners so they can go back and reference all the titles that we're throwing out, because we're not even halfway through with throwing out even more titles for you guys and recommendations. I think this is a good point for us to segue into our film that we're going to be talking about. And again, that's Fear No Evil from 1969.
Hidden in mystery and superstition is the promise of love beyond infinity, as Louis Jourdan stars in Fear No Evil.
We find ourselves face to face with the whole bag of tricks. All those things that simply can't be, could be, might be, sometimes are, no matter how much that jolts our comfortable common sense universe.
What are you trying to do, resurrect the dead?
Tell me his name. Say it in this place. Your demon's here, feeling the air's moving. No. See his eyes.
You don't think the girl is simply ill?
I believe there's something in the mirror.
Then I suggest that your patient is in grave danger.
This has a Kino Lorber Blu-ray release. It's on a double feature with Ritual of Evil. And as of this recording, it has 286 views on Letterboxd.
Why? It should have 10,000.
We say that about so many of the movies we cover on here, but, you know, this is part of the point of us having that rule for the podcast, is to hopefully get those numbers up for it. As I mentioned earlier, this was originally aired back in March of 1969. This was a pilot TV movie originally intended to kick off a series called Bedeviled that was going to star Louis Jourdan, and him being a psychiatrist whose cases kind of delve into the supernatural. So he would basically have a new case every week. The series itself didn't end up happening, I think, from what I read, and Amanda, if you can confirm, because Night Gallery came out and it was too similar. So instead, we just got the sequel, Ritual of Evil.
I'm of a couple of different minds of this. I don't know why it didn't get greenlit. So one of the things, and we probably read the same articles, was that psychiatrist shows were really popular at the time. Mm-hmm. And then they thought, well, let's just make it supernatural, you know, and that's really fascinating. But from what I read online, where people were saying it got really good reviews and it got really good ratings, but I looked up the ratings and they were very low. Mm-hmm. It came in at number 104 for the season out of 181. Now, at the time, they were calculating all the movies. So that means if they reran a theatrical on television, it was being lumped with the TV movies, because there weren't enough TV movies to compile these kinds of lists like there were later. Mm-hmm. But the numbers were pretty good, because all we had back then were three channels. So everybody was watching TV at this point. So the ratings were 18.8/31. And that's really hard to look at and do the math. But that basically means that 31% of people with televisions who were watching TV on the night that this aired were tuned in to watch Fear No Evil. So that means like almost a third of America. So that sounds really big, but it still wasn't big enough. That's how many people watched these three channels back then to get it even into the top 100 made for TV movies. And the couple of reviews I saw were not very kind. And so I don't know where that information comes from, but I kind of feel like, and I don't know how, I didn't look up Ritual of Evil to see where it ranked, but I think that it did struggle a little, and probably Night Gallery might have created an issue. But I'm thinking back to like when Twilight Zone was airing, and there was another show that predates it called One Step Beyond. Mm-hmm. And everybody talks about Twilight Zone. Nobody ever talks about One Step Beyond. And that's just blasphemy to me, but because it's a great show. But Once Up Beyond only went off the air because John Newland, who was the director and the host of the show, felt like they couldn't keep going with the type of stories they were telling. It wasn't a social commentary show. It was just like a look at the paranormal. Mm-hmm. And so those two shows were both very popular at the time that they were running. So it's not like you couldn't have dueling shows. But I guess because Night Gallery was also NBC, maybe they just figured they had to pick one, or Rod Serling was the cachet there for them. But I don't know. I do think that that idea that it was like this huge blockbuster TV movie is a misnomer.
I mean, no shade on Rod Serling because he is sexy as well, but
He's a little sexy. I have to agree.
But if I have to choose, I'm going to go with Mr. Suave, Louis Jourdan, especially smoking a cigarette. It's just, I mean, no pants, folks.
Yeah. I kept thinking that when I was watching this, because I actually just watched some Murder Under Glass, the Columbo episode recently too. Mm-hmm. And he plays the suave, you know, killer. But in this, his hair is always perfect. And I'm just like, he just wakes up like Ritual of Evil. I think he wakes up after having like this sexy orgy dream. And you're like, oh gosh, he looks so good.
Yeah, he does. So I didn't delve too far into his other films besides the ones that I'd already seen, which were Swamp Thing and Return of Swamp Thing. but Lance, I saw you watched a couple of things recently that he's in.
I did. I mean, my favorite is his Antonin Arcane in Swamp Thing. Yeah. I wish he made so many more of those. I think Louis Jourdan's a perfect villain. That's why I don't know if I did. I mean, we'll talk about his character in Fear No Evil as being kind of like the hero.
Yeah.
I didn't quite click with his character because I see him as a villain more so than a hero.
I can see that.
But yeah, I watched Octopussy for the first time. I had never seen that before. He plays Kamal Khan, a villain.
Yeah.
To me, he's kind of like an evil doppelganger to Roger Moore. They don't physically look that much alike, but they dress and kind of their mannerisms are so similar in this Bond movie that I enjoyed it. I know a lot of people don't like the Roger Moore Bonds.
I don't like any James Bond movies. I'm gonna say it. Like, I know that's not a popular opinion, but honestly, the ones that I've watched, my entire takeaway of it is, oh, okay, so his dick saved the world. Like, if he did not sleep with this person, like
it's odd. It's odd having Roger Moore walk into a room and women are like, yeah, oh my God, I really want this man.
I can't get down with the James.
But it's the swap. It's the attitude. He has this aura.
I get it. I get it. It's sexy. Sean Connery, all, you know, it's all sexy, but it's just not for me. I'm just going to leave it at that. It's not for me. The Bond movies don't. But yeah. I am curious about, you watched him as Count Dracula.
Yes.
Oh, I have not seen this.
Oh, it's actually he's actually a good count because he's very suave. He's very Louis Jourdan, and he's sexy in it. And that's kind of how I want my Dracula.
Right.
I do think Van Helsing kind of steals the show. But yeah, no, I think it's effective. It's about 2.5 hours, the movie.
Yeah, it was PBS or something, I think, originally aired it.
Yeah, exactly. Who is it? Finlay plays Van Helsing, who's really great in it. Frank Finlay.
Oh, sick. Okay.
But yeah, I think it's a very true, it's more true, obviously, than Coppola's adaptation of Bram Stoker's novel, but it's a very true adaptation. I think it works really well. I had a lot of fun with it.
Watch listed. Excellent.
Yeah, it's 2.5 hours, though. That's the it's long.
Can I recommend something for Erica that of she course. Might enjoy? So I don't know that much about Louis Jourdan's acting career, but in the early 80s, he was the host of a TV show called Romance Theater. Mm-hmm. And Romance Theater is like the greatest thing that ever happened to my 10-year-old brain, because what it was it was a weekly series, like, and it was like a novella. Every week they had a different story. And it was always like a love story, and it ran in the daytime against soap operas on syndicated channels. And it was just for 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, they would tell one story. And Louis Jourdan was one of the hosts of the show. And he would open up every episode and he'd always say something like, "And now we'll only speak of love." And then they'll cut to like the whatever. And they released them, I think, most of them, not all of them, on VHS, and I have them all.
Oh, wow.
And they only have the opening segment that he does. They don't have, I don't remember if he came on every day. I think he did, but they just have the one first segment that he does. And they're great because if you add 22 minutes together times five, it's longer than a regular movie. Mm-hmm. So they're like 2 hours long and they're they're shot on video and they're incredible. But, they had weird hosts. Like I think Dr. Joyce Brothers was a host for a while. Somebody else, a famous gossip columnist, Rona Barrett or somebody like that. But Louis Jourdan is the only one who ends up on the releases. And I think he did several interviews about it too. And I think he actually said things like, "We'll only speak of love on romance theater." And it just makes my heart melt. And that's who I think of when when you talk about him playing villains and stuff, I just, in my head, he's just this like romantic guy. And so I have such a hard time like thinking of him as like a bad person. Of course, he's really good in that Columbo episode, which I watched just last week. But yeah, he's a good romantic hero, I think.
I guess I can sort of see it both ways. And one thing that I thought was interesting is, so the Kino Lorber Blu-ray has a commentary from Gary Gerani. He mentioned that he had briefly corresponded with Jourdan and asked him about this role, and that Jourdan had said, had said that the role of Sorel to him was, quote, inspiring, a latter-day angel in human form. So I think he likes playing that type. I don't know. Yeah. Like, it just sounds like it based on that quote.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's great in the role of Dr. Sorel. I mean, I think he's great in everything he does. He's always suave, no matter if he's villain or hero or good guy. But yeah, I would be totally infatuated. I think anybody would be in a role like this. I really wish it was like a weekly series.
Yeah, for sure.
I do think that we'll probably talk about it, but the character development of Dr. Sorel in Fear No Evil, I think it's a little quick. The introduction is fantastic. I love this opening scene with Jourdan in there, but I actually prefer Ritual of Evil because I feel like his character is more established, more developed. I believe him more as the good guy in this because he seems more on the psychiatrist element for Ritual of Evil and less like completely just engrossed in the occult.
Yeah.
He goes to his mentor more so in Ritual of Evil. But yeah, no, I think he is an angel.
Yeah, he is. I can see that. And yeah, I did see your ratings and I actually wasn't surprised that you liked Ritual more than Fear. And I can see now why for sure. I think a lot of my liking Fear No Evil slightly more than Ritual has not just to do with Jourdan's character, but the other co-star of this, Linda Day George, who I love. And honestly, I mentioned being on a TV movie binge. I've also been on a Linda Day George binge as well.
You can't go wrong with that.
No. And she'll probably end up being my most watched actor on Letterboxd this year, just because of this like last month or so. So in the commentary, it was mentioned that her casting was very deliberate. They were looking for someone who quote, exuded radiance, and freshness, hope, and the spirit of life itself. And yeah, that's Linda.
She's the epitome of that.
Yeah, she did an interview years ago. I don't even, you can watch it on YouTube with her husband, who she wasn't married to him at this point, but Christopher George. Mm-hmm. And I don't even remember what show was or how I even came upon it. But they, like, apparently he loves to cook and she loves to fix things. And so they have these different roles in the household. And they did a whole interview about like how she fixes toilets and stuff. And he like makes dinner and she's amazing. And she's this really bright light, you know what I mean? And of course he was also his own bright light. Christopher George was perfection to me, but yeah. And he did it. He gave himself 110% to every role. And I think she did too. And that's why those movies, the like pieces that I think you could probably pick apart critically, but like there's something about those two people that just brings so much to film. And, but it's a really fun interview and she's just really happy to be there and talking about fixing toilets or whatever. And it's great.
Yeah. I think Christopher George will probably be my second most watched actor because, you know, they starred in a lot of these movies together. Pieces obviously being number one, and I would never pick that movie apart. I love it.
It's great. It's great.
Love it. Mortuary from 1983.
My favorite.
Beyond Evil, which I just watched recently. And that was a lot of fun. Vinegar Syndrome has a release of this. It's on Tubi. If anyone wants to watch it, it's got major Italian vibes going on. I think it would be a great double feature with Mausoleum. But TV movies I've watched with her recently. I just want to get back to Christopher George because, you know, he does give over 100% in every single role that he's in, no matter what. And that includes when he poses for Playgirl.
Folks. Oh, yeah.
Folks, yeah. If you haven't seen this, I will gladly gift you with a picture of Christopher George holding a watermelon while posing for Playgirl.
Was his knife in his mouth? Is that the weird, like, he's eating it off the knife?
Yeah. Love it. So good. So a couple movies I watched with him that I really enjoyed. Immortal from 1969.
Oh, yeah. The pilot movie?
The pilot movie, yeah. This great concept about him having blood that rejuvenates. So there's the sort of level of vampirism to it, which was kind of interesting. And then this other one I really enjoyed called Escape from 1971.
Oh, yeah.
He plays an escape artist, but who is basically like solving crimes. It's really neat. These were both on YouTube. Unfortunately, they don't have releases.
No, I think that's also a pilot. And it was directed by John Llewellyn Moxie, who's one of the greats of the small screen.
Absolutely. But getting back to Linda, a couple other films that I watched with her for TV movies, Cruise into Terror, 1978.
Oh, so good.
So fun. There's a mummy on. It's got Grumpy Ray Milland, first of all, so that should sell anybody on it. And there is a miniature sarcophagus at the bottom of the sea that supposedly has the devil's son in it. And so they go on a salvaging mission, and there's people who want to bring it up and, you know, open it and get the gold from the sarcophagus, and those who don't, but bad things start happening. Linda DeGeorge, Christopher George, Ray Milland. It's great.
It's got this great, like, it's got these two young girls on the ship together, and one's supposed to be ugly because she wears glasses.
Right. Yeah. That trope.
And you're like, oh yeah, she's such a dog. And like, and it's funny because she played a fake angel on the fake angel episode of Charlie's Angels, where these three girls pretend like they're Charlie's Angels. And she's married to Alan Ormsby, who did Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things and Death Dream. And she's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But like, it's hilarious because through that whole movie, that's all, I'm like, eye roll. Like, okay, yeah, she's the ugly one on the ship, and I don't buy it. And also, the guy who did the score to that, I think his name is Gerald Free, he just passed away. And, you know, you can buy that soundtrack on CD.
Oh, wow.
If you're interested. Yeah. And I picked it up after he died because I remembered I tried to buy it beforehand and it was sold out, but they reprinted it. And I went ahead and bought myself a copy of it. And it's pretty incredible.
Nice. I'll find a link to that and put that in show notes for folks. A few others I watched with her. This one was really fun too, because I love animal attack movies, or insect attack movies, rather. Yeah. Ants from 1977.
Yeah, that's great. And also Robert Foxworth. Foxworth is like my God. Big crush.
Another weird crush this might be a weird crush to some folks. I watched She Cried Murder from 1973.
I was going to recommend that one.
Yeah, Telly Savalas. I mean, whenever he says, "Who loves you, baby?" I just, you know, come on.
But. Oh, he's great. He's great. And that's when I was talking about Night Terror, it's comparable to She Cried Murder, because that's another one that, and it's almost like a sequel to Fear No Evil in that it's about a widow, much like, so she's not married in Fear No Evil yet, but she loses her husband. And then she's got this kid, and she sees this murder committed by Telly Savalas. And then when she calls the police, who comes to the door, but Telly Savalas, he's a cop. And so she's like, oh, I didn't see anything, but he knows now that she's seen him. And so it's a chase film. So it's much like Night Terror, except she's mostly on foot, but it's about how she stays one step ahead of him through the whole thing. And it's a really great movie where she's been undermined the whole time, because even when, she's like, oh, I didn't see anything. And she's staying with this woman. I can't remember the relationship with the woman, but she says to Telly Savalas, oh, you know, she's not thinking right. Her husband just died. And it's this whole hysterical woman trope that she like totally flips on its ear. And she's like, nope, I'm going to like survive and get my son back. And there's nothing you can do about it. And it's a really kind of empowering film in that way.
Yeah. I enjoyed that one a lot.
That's great. Yeah.
And then one other I watched, she has a small role in this. This is more of a Christopher George movie, but, and also Janet Leigh, House on Green Apple Road from 1970. So and not to take away from Linda DeGeorge, but, you know, like I mentioned, she does have a small role in this. This is more about, to me, it was more about Janet Leigh, because she's playing a role in 1970 where she is a housewife who is concerned about getting older and being unattractive and trying to find validation in other relationships. And it's like this perfectly cast movie. Christopher George is a detective investigating what he thinks is a murder that's happened. It's really good. I don't want to give too much away about the film, but I would definitely recommend it. That's another one that is, out there and available for you to find. And
yeah, it's actually on Blu-ray or DVD because they released, it was a pilot for Dan August, the TV series, which ended up starring Burt Reynolds because Christopher George couldn't do it. And he actually recommended a then unknown Burt Reynolds. And then that had took on a life of its own after Burt Reynolds got famous. But the movie is really interesting because the movie's about, supposedly you think, because it spun off Dan August, about this detective, but it really becomes about Janet Leigh and what's become of her and her life and how she got to the point where this supposed murder took place. And it's such an amazing film because I think it really does capture the way a lot of women in that stage of their life feel. And he's kind of narrating her story and not the other way around. And it's really amazing and it's very sensitive and thoughtful too.
Yeah. So we also have Bradford Dillman, a well-known character actor. He's in Piranha 1978, The Way We Were, Escape from Planet of the Apes, Sudden Impact, and The Enforcer. He's also in Guyana, Cult of the Damned from 1979, which I just watched. And it's not as good as the Powers Booth one, but it is good. He was in a movie called The Amsterdam Kill from 1977, starring Robert Mitchum, which was pretty good as well. Golden Harvest production randomly in that one. So Yuen Bao and Lam Ching Ying are in it. It's random. Another fun animal attack movie, Chosen Survivors. He's in that. That one's about people being trapped in an underground bunker with bats. Ooh. They're not Carlo Rambaldi bats, though, folks. Don't get too excited, unfortunately. But some other TV movies that he has starred in that I've really enjoyed, The Mephisto Waltz from 1971.
Oh, that's actual theatrical, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, is it?
That is Paul Wendkos, though. He directed that, director of this.
Oh, okay. Yeah. For whatever reason, I thought it was TV, but I think I was just assuming because of who the director was. So good to know. But that one, I enjoyed that one a lot. Yeah, same director. And then another one, and I think you brought this one up in your lecture, Amanda, was Revenge from 1971, starring Shelley Winters.
Yeah, that's like one of my favorite films. And it's wild. That one might actually even be a good gateway movie because although it needs to be restored, I think, because it's really beautifully shot and it's hard to see that in the uploads that exist. Mm-hmm. But like, Shelley Winters is like grieving the loss of her daughter who's committed suicide. And she's pretty sure that it's because Bradford Dillman had sex with her and then dumped her. And he's this married man. And so she kidnaps him and she keeps him in a cage in the basement of this like really gothic house that she has. And his wife hires a guy who's like a psychic played by Stuart Whitman, another huge crush. Don't even get me started on Stuart Whitman. He makes me weak. He's like, oh, you know, I just tell people I'm a psychic. But she actually, the wife, starts tuning into her own psychic powers. And it's really great because I don't want to say we should legitimize it, but it's a film among another TV movie I can think of called Night Cries that legitimizes female intuition that I really like. And it's such an incredible film. And it's also sad because it's coming from a place of like real pain for Shelley Winters' character. And I think by the end of the film, it's never fully stated what Bradford Dillman, if he was even involved with the daughter. There's a lot of gray area as to what happened and why the daughter killed herself. And it's kind of a really interesting film. Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, it's great. So further into the cast, we also have Carol O'Connor. He plays Miles Donovan, a colleague of Bradford Dillman's character. Carol O'Connor has close to 100 acting credits, mix of theatrical films, TV movies, TV shows, probably most well known as Archie Bunker from All in the Family or the In the Heat of the Night TV series. Two other cast members I want to bring up just briefly. Wilfred Hyde White, he plays Harry Snowden. He's the mentor to Sorrel. Has 160 plus film, television, and stage credits. He was in The Third Man from 1949 and My Fair Lady from 1964. And then Marcia Hunt, who plays Mrs. Varney or Paul's mother. She was an MGM actor in the 1940s mostly before she was blacklisted. Some films that I watched from her recently, Raw Deal from 1948 and Back from the Dead, 1957. Enjoyed both of those a lot. She's also in Johnny Got His Gun from 1971, which I have not watched yet, but that's because I'm waiting for John to read the book because he's like, I want to read the book first. I'm like, fine.
It's a good book. It's a good book. And it's, I remember the movie being pretty good, but I haven't seen it. You remember the Metallica video that uses clips from the movie?
Yeah.
That's what made me want to see it when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And so I read the book and then, and I loved it. And then I saw the movie, but I think, I don't think the movie was as good as the book, but I'm doing that off memory now.
Yeah. I'm sure it's not. I'm just, my book is sitting on the shelf. I'm like, John, can you read the book so we can watch the damn movie? But Marsha Hunt actually died fairly recently in September of 2022 at the age of 104.
Wow. Yeah,
she had a long ass life.
I learned we shared a birthday, October 17th as well.
And
I
saw,
that's
every time I celebrate, I'm going to think of Marsha.
There you go.
Moving forward.
As you should.
Fun fact that also came up in the commentary is that she was the honorary mayor of Sherman Oaks, California.
Yeah.
And that was current as of the commentary. So, yeah, it's interesting. All right. So let's get into the crew for this. We've brought up the director a few times already, Paul Wendkos. He has over 100 credits between film and television. Already mentioned were The Mephisto Waltz from 1971. Amanda, you mentioned this one earlier, but another one that I really enjoy as well. And I prefer this much more. I've brought this up with Lance. There's another Lizzie Borden adaptation with Chloe Sevigny and Kristen Stewart, which I just don't care for at all. This is the one, the Elizabeth Montgomery one, is the Lizzie Borden adaptation for me.
Yeah, that movie is everything. Like, and that's another good gateway film. People love it. And it's not like a ton happens in it, but like, it was such an important, like, okay, so the TV, and I'll make this brief because I know this isn't the subject, but the TV movie career of Elizabeth Montgomery is a very important one for the history of made for TV movies, but also an important one for Elizabeth Montgomery because she did The Victim before she did this. And it was her first dramatic appearance in like a decade because she had done Bewitched. And right after Bewitched went off the air, she was very specific about the kind of role she would take. And she did a variety of different things throughout the rest of her career. But she turned down many, many, many theatrical roles because they were always for supporting characters because they weren't making movies with women in the lead, you know, as much. And she's like, why would I do that when I can star in my own movie? And these movies are made for an audience that I really appreciate and stuff. And she talks about this in interviews and stuff.
Yeah.
But that movie was the movie that I think everybody sat down and watched and they were like, wow, she is not Samantha on Bewitched. This is a powerhouse actress that can do a gazillion different things. And from there on, she was able to kind of establish herself, I think, in the exact kind of film she wanted to make. And she did a variety of made-for-TV movies, and they're all amazing. So that's like a really important film.
I definitely recommend that one for folks. Agree with Amanda. Definitely a good gateway film as well. Some other credits for Wendkos include The Bad Seed from 1985. And I am a fan of any Bad Seed film adaptation, no matter what. The Brotherhood of the Bell, 1970, starring Glenn Ford. It's a decent conspiracy theory film. The Five of Me from 1981.
Oh, so good. I love this movie.
Yeah. David Burney, Dee Wallace, Judith Chapman, who she was in Scalpel.
Scalpel. And a soap star. Yeah. She's amazing.
Yes.
She's great in this. She's not one of the main people. It's mainly David Burney and Dee Wallace and him dealing with multiple personalities based on a true story. Really interesting background on this one. So hard recommend on that one.
That's an interesting one too, because I think that one of the producers on that was John Newland, who was the star and director of One Step Beyond, that show I mentioned that ran alongside Twilight Zone. So he produced a lot of really amazing TV movies.
Nice. What else? A Little Game from 1971.
Oh, I love this movie.
One Diane Baker. Oh my God, this kid is fucking terrifying. he's so scary.
Is that him in the poster?
That's him in the poster, but he doesn't look quite like that in the movie, but he is terrifying. Ugh,
yeah, like I don't have the poster pulled up, but I remember he kind of looked like a little Paul Williams.
A little Lord Fauntleroy is what I always think of. Yeah, he's got that bold Peter Tork haircut.
Yikes.
That's a great movie. Ed Nelson is this adult character in it that has to go toe to toe with him because he's pretty sure something bad happened with the kid at school, possibly killing a schoolmate. And Diane Baker's is really like, I'll just be over here pretending like my son's not evil.
Right.
And so he has to like do all this stuff up against this kid. And he's got this friend, the little boy, that's great. And it's got this weird ending with the little boy kind of narrating what he thinks happened. And it's such a weird little movie, but I love it.
It's so good. I would love more people to watch this film because scared. I mean, I know I don't like kids, folks. Everyone knows that. But like this child terrified me. So I'm just saying. a few others he did. And this one, this was probably one of my favorites that I watched from Wendkos. A Death of Innocence from 1971, starring Shelley Winters. So Shelley Winters and her husband, they go to New York. Their daughter has been charged with murder. And the majority of the film is the court case. But through the trial, Shelley Winters is learning that her daughter is not the innocent person that she thought that she was. And what's really interesting, too, is that this idea of never telling your child no, giving them everything that they want, what that does to them psychologically can actually make them act out and try to, you know, do things like this in order to be punished because they actually crave punishment. Really good movie in that respect, because it reinforces my, I know I don't have kids and I have nothing to stand on with this, but when parents don't tell their kids no, you're just setting your child up to be a monster. And this movie supports my case.
Yay.
And then another one of my favorites that I watched from Wendkos, Lance, I know you watched this one too. And Amanda, I believe that you and Dan talked about this on your podcast, Cocaine, One Man's Seduction.
Oh, was that Paul Wendkos?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that movie's bananas. I love it. Dennis Weaver is like, and it's funny that I didn't mention Duel as a gateway. I mean, that's the gateway to the movie. But like Dennis Weaver is unashamedly like big when he wants to be. And he gives really big performances from time to time. And that movie, he's just like, I'm going to go for it. And it's amazing. It's off the rocker. Amazing. And I think James Spader's in it.
Yeah.
And Karen Grassl.
Jeffrey Tambor plays. Victim.
And like, yeah, it's got this really amazing cast but he's just wild in it. And it's a really pretty amazing movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Dennis Weaver. Cause I watched this after, what was it called? Terror on the Beach.
Oh, that's a good one too.
Was another starring Dennis Weaver, Paul Wendkos directed. Mm-hmm. But Dennis Weaver, he consistently plays a dad who really demands his son to go to college very well.
That's the trope, yeah.
Yeah, he's got that trait down. But yeah, I watched Terror on the Beach, which was a CBS Tuesday night movie. The quote on the ad, it was family battles for its life against a sinister cult group.
Oh.
But it's actually just a bunch of hippies with the family at a beach. And it causes tension between the family who are already dealing with their own internal struggles. But so they start kind of fighting amongst each other. Mm. But it was fun. Roberta Collins, she plays one of the young hippie kids.
Sick. I love Roberta Collins.
It's also really beautifully filmed. It's got some really great camera work in that. And I don't think it's ever had like a legitimate release. And it would benefit from that because it's a really beautiful looking movie.
Any others you watched from Wayne?
I watched Haunts of the Very Rich.
Oh, I love that one. I'm so glad you mentioned it.
Yeah, another great cast. Lloyd Bridges, Cloris Leachman, Robert Reed. So you have Mike Brady playing this depressed reverend in it. Anne Francis is in it. Ed Asner. It's about these wealthy passengers going to like this undisclosed location that's called the Portals of Eden. And none of them really have any idea where it is, what country it's located in. But as they begin trying to figure out what's going on, there's kind of the supernatural element, and they've each find out that they've each had these near death experiences recently. Hmm. So some pretty fun twists. It's a very cool idea, kind of Twilight Zone feeling. My review was, you know, it's a very cool idea, but it's difficult to fully enjoy when you're dead. That's the way I felt.
I think that movie is one of my favorite Robert Reed performances. And I do show that when I do lectures on like actors who use the TV movie, like Elizabeth Montgomery, to like kind of shed that TV sitcom persona that they've developed. And Robert Reed actually was very aware of that. So, you know, when he was doing the Brady Bunch, he was also doing Mannix and playing a detective on that. And he was purposely trying to like make sure he wasn't going to always be Mr. Brady. And he knew somewhere in his head he probably would be. And so he did a variety of made for TV movies. He did one called Secret Night Caller. That's fucking off the charts. It's so good. And it's like, that's a powerhouse performance. But this is a really good example of how diverse and talented Robert Reed was. He's probably my favorite made for TV movie actor. And I will defend him in everywhere across the board. He made so many good made for TV movies, and sometimes he took smaller roles like in Nightmare in Bottom County. Mm-hmm. because the role separated him from the Brady Bunch. Like, and so he did a lot of different things and a lot of episodic television as well. But this movie, he's got this great monologue where he goes out into the jungles and he starts talking about, he introduces this idea, maybe we are dead. Yeah. And he's kind of lost his soul in this process, this priest. And it's really amazing. And it's such a great monologue. And I will play it sometimes when I give my lectures, just as an example.
Nice. One last one I want to bring up from Wencos, and this is one that you also brought up in your write-up in your book, Amanda, for Fear No Evil, and that's Good Against Evil from 1977. Yeah. It's Rosemary's Baby Exorcist mashup written by Jimmy Sangster, starring Richard Lynch.
And Dak Rambo.
Yeah, Dak Rambo. I can't forget him.
Please don't.
This one was a lot of fun as well. Definitely recommend folks checking this one out.
But if you want to get Ramboed, that might be a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should all want to get Ramboed.
I think so.
All right. Let's talk about the score really quickly. That is done by Billy Goldenberg. He has almost 200 credits between television and film. He's won 3 primetime Emmys. He's been nominated 22 times. He worked steadily from 1968 through the 1990s. Or the commentator mentioned that he was influenced by Stravinsky and waltzes, and that he mostly did show tunes throughout his career. And he kind of thought that a movie like this was out of his wheelhouse. But I think he did a really great job with it. He actually used some demon names being whispered throughout the score, kind of like, I'm not going to compare this to, you know, the score from Suspiria right. or anything like this, but I think it's interesting, like he had these books for his research and he would put the names of them kind of whispered throughout in there very subtly. There's also whistling sounds from the Stanley Steamer car that's used in this. Mm. And I guess apparently later Goldenberg became convinced that there was some kind of malevolence attached to the books he used for his research because they kept making their way back to him despite him trying to get rid of them.
Ooh.
Which I thought that was an interesting little story about that.
The guy who did the commentary for Fear No Evil, we should promote this a little. His name's Gary Gerani, which mm-hmm. you mentioned, and yeah. he made a documentary on Billy Goldenberg, and he's a huge fan of his, and it just came out on a Blu-ray as part of a featurette for a movie. I think it's the UFO Incident, and so I haven't watched it yet, but I just bought it recently. And Gary's a really cool guy, and he's super knowledgeable about this stuff, and he's got a great voice. He's perfect for commentaries. And this was Billy Goldenberg's first TV movie. You know, of course, he would go on to do Duel,
yeah,
and which I think he's most famous for. And I think you can get that on CD as well, and that's a pretty incredible soundtrack. But this one, I think I remembered reading that because he did the soundtrack to Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, another mm-hmm. John Newland film, and I think he was talking about wanting to try a bunch of different sounds and make these kind of discordant tunes and to kind of like make that eerie. But also in the scenes that are not violent or scary, he's got this really booming kind of score happening, like with Linda Day George and stuff. And it gives this film a really kind of cinematic flavor. But this was like his first TV movie, and then he would just go on, and that's kind of all he did. And I got to meet him briefly, I don't know, many years ago, because he was the composer. And he would perform with Bea Arthur at her one-woman show, which I saw three times, and I got to meet her. And I got to meet him, and he was really nice. And interestingly enough, he was hanging out with one of David Green's ex-wives, and David Green was a huge made-for-TV movie guy. He did Roots and Rich Man, Poor Man and stuff. And I think he had 7 wives, and I met one of the exes, and I think he'd already been passed away for a while. Yeah. And I said, I love your husband, and she said, I do too. No. And that's what I remember about that. But he was really nice. And that was a really incredible night for me.
That's awesome. Yeah. Besides Duel and Don't Be Afraid of the Dark that Amanda mentioned, he also did the scores for Lizzie Borden and the follow-up to Fear No Evil, Ritual.
Yeah. Table. Also very good.
Yeah. Screenwriters, or rather teleplay writers, learning the verbiage here. Richard Allen Simmons, and then Guy Endor wrote the story. He also wrote the novel The Werewolf of Paris, which The Curse of the Werewolf, 1961, starring Oliver Reed, is based. He's also a screenwriter, story writer, and contributing writer to a few films in 1935 that a lot of people have probably seen, including Mad Love, Mark of the Vampire, and The Raven.
Wow.
Interesting career from him.
Yeah.
Then some other quick production info. I already mentioned that this was a pilot TV movie for a show called Bedeviled. I think something that came up as well, this was in 1969, and sort of coming off of the success of Rosemary's Baby, having that sort of supernatural devil element, the commentator, Gary Gerani, mentioned that Dillman has a very Cassavetes quality to him, and that was very deliberate casting, which I wasn't thinking about it, but as soon as he said it, I couldn't not see it.
I got a Anthony Perkins vibe from him when I first watched it. But then, when I listened to Gary's commentary, I was like, oh, I could see Cassavetes too.
Yeah. So the film itself was out of circulation for years. It aired twice. In 1979, it repeated on Saturday night at the movies. And then it was thought to have been burned in the famous Universal fire, but obviously it did not, because we have the Blu-ray for it today and it's been found and lovingly restored. Some of the shooting locations in this are interesting as well. There's a lot shot in downtown LA. There's some shots on the Universal lot. There is the San Rafael Mansion in Pasadena, which is used in a lot of other films. And then most famously, the opening scene is in the Bradbury Building, which is in a lot of TV shows, films, music videos. Blade Runner is probably the most famous film that it's been in.
No, Angel or Angel 2. Isn't the building used in, I think it's Angel 2.
Oh, I don't know.
At the end, speaking of babies and stuff. And it was also in this Charles Bronson TV movie called Donato and Daughter. As well.
Yeah. I mean, the Bradbury Building should have its own IMDb.
Yeah.
it's got a Wikipedia page that lists all of the movies that it's been featured in, but really it's a star, the building itself. It's just gorgeous. And then the last bit of production info that I thought was interesting, the car that they're driving in when they have their car accident, the Stanley Steamer, is a real Stanley Steamer that they rented, demolished in that accident, and then they rebuilt it before returning it. I thought that was interesting.
That's the budget.
That's mild. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to get into our thoughts about the film right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Lance, I'm going to start with you. What are some things about this film that you think make it a horror movie? Or what are some things that sort of qualify it for unsung horrors?
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of people that do watch TV movies, they kind of judge a lot of these based on how minimal a lot of the horror is. You know, there's not a lot of gore. Due to network restrictions, there's not a lot of gore. You're not going to get any nudity. So I think a lot of people do need to take a step back and realize what you're watching and what the rules are. So Fear No Evil, I think, is a horror through and through. I mean, from the start, I think I loved the opening. It sets up that there's obviously something that, you know, unseen and unknown, this unseen, unknown hook of this man just completely in this trance. Dillman's doing an amazing job acting his brains out, I think, just letting you know that something horrific just happened from this experience he had in this building. So I feel like that the beginning sets up the horror tone immediately. And then there's I have some favorite scenes that I think fit into the horror genre. Barbara going over to Paul's mother's house, mm-hmm. when there's all these kind of supernatural elements. It's windy. The wind's really billowing. It's dark. It's shot beautifully. The angles throughout the whole film, like all the Paul Wincoast movies, actually, I watched for the podcast. This was my favorite as far as the cinematography and the framing goes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you see creepy mannequins are always scary in movies. with Paul's outfit he had on in the car wreck, and then I love Paul Varney's mother. She just has this horror element to her throughout the whole movie. I mean, and I think the biggest horror element is the actual tape that you listen to before you see the situation that mm-hmm. actually occurred at the end of the movie. that the voices used, that from Paul Varney character, yeah, and him yelling, it's just anguish and terror, and it's really portraying possession really well and scary. I can imagine like an audience in 1969 watching that, and they're like, holy shit, turn this off. Like, that would be the point where a lot of people, I think, would be freaked out.
Yeah, I think so too. One of the things that Gary brought up in the commentary, he called this poetic horror, which I like that. I like that term a lot. And he said it was created through the editing, shot composition. So you mentioned cinematography already, the use of a star lens frequently, those handheld camera shots, which create that sort of chaos and tension and off-kilter angles, the pacing and the casting. And another thing that, you know, you've brought up before, Amanda, and also Elaine Rippling brought up in her book, is pacing in these movies. Every single scene in a TV movie moves the plot further along. Like, nothing is laid to waste. And I love that about them. Like, there is no, well, that scene, why do we need that scene for? Like, that didn't move anything along. We didn't learn anything new about it. And I really enjoy that.
I think there are some scenes. I mean, I do think every scene is essential in Fear No Evil. I found a couple that kind of lingered a little long. Particularly, I loved the first scene when Barbara sees Paul in the mirror for the first time.
Yeah.
And then there's this makeout session, you know, it's very kind of romantic, you know, they're kind of reunited and they're kissing. Yeah. And that scene goes on a little longer than I feel is necessary. It's almost like 4 minutes of just them. And I know it's risque at the time for, you know, again, you kind of have to take a step back and realize, okay, you're watching a made for TV movie from the 60s. There are these restrictions.
Right.
So I think it's progressive in that way. And I think it's a lot of people hadn't seen anything like that on television before. But watching it now, I was like, that scene goes on quite a bit.
It does. I think what's interesting about it too is that it evolves from not just like her seeing her husband in the mirror and having these, I'll call them erotic moments with them. You know, I think especially for the time, just them holding each other and kissing for them, it's erotic. But then it evolves into vampirism because he's draining her life and you've got these blood marks on the neck. And I'm like, what, the vampires now? What's going on? I love it. What's happening?
Yeah, I think I wrote it as like bloodletting and I do think it's really erotic. Like, I'm one of those kind of people, you can fade out during a sex scene. Like, I'm totally into it. But like, so I like this kind of like stuff. And it's what you're saying, in 1969, that's pretty heavy duty stuff, because he's like basically trying to hump this woman through the mirror, you know, and the idea of it is really fascinating and interesting and creepy, but also like sexy and sexual, and she likes it, you know what I mean? And so like, it's this really amazing, I always love when he shows up in the mirror, she can't stop it because like, Sorrell is like, just put a cover over the mirror for one night, just cover it up. Don't remove the cover, whatever you do. And she does it for like an hour. And then she's like, I have to see if he's back there, you know? Yeah. And then she wants it more and more. And it's an interesting thing in 1969, because when she's at Paul's apartment in the opening and Carol O'Connor shows up, first of all, he's creepy as all get out.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's like, I like watching you make the drink or whatever. And I'm like, okay, he's already gone too far. But one thing she says is, what do you do for the 3 weeks before you get married? And Carol O'Connor says, make love. And she says, oh yeah, that sounds good. And there, and then later on, Paul shows up and he makes a statement about how sometimes they live in sin. And I think in 1969, this idea of like her having sex before she gets married, it was probably a pretty big idea to put out on television. I don't know that you saw a lot of that. And the fact that she was willingly going into this other world that she had no idea what was on the other side because of the longing for this man, it's like, it's pretty cool and like wild to think about.
Yeah. There's this whole aspect to it about the mirror, there being this peeping Tom element to it as well, where, you know, you actually see some of the shots look like they're coming from the point of view of the mirror, which is unsettling for me. I mean, I might have like taken some personal stuff into this, because I don't think I've told this story on this podcast before, but when I was growing up, I had the room upstairs in the front of the house, and I had a neighbor across the street, Steve. I remember your name, Steve. And I would see him sitting in the front of his, like the front window of their house with binoculars.
Oh, wow.
Like looking outside. And so even if I had the blinds closed,
was he looking at you or just around?
You can't really tell because it was far away, right. But I assumed he was like looking in there. And so I developed a complex of like always changing in the bathroom. Like I would never undress in my bedroom because of you, Steve. So like this idea of, I mean, obviously it's a little bit different for Linda Day George's character in this because she wants what's in that mirror, but the idea of this thing in there is always watching it's unsettling for me. I do like the effects that they created with it. Gerani did an interview with the editor who said those mirror scene special effects were achieved through matte shots and rear projection. It might look dated to some folks as far as special effects goes, but for 1969, yeah. I thought it looked great.
Yeah.
I thought it was
really effective.
I think the other, I wouldn't necessarily call it a special effect because it's really just a negative exposure print, but like the very end when they replay the car accident and it's the negative exposure.
Yeah.
And then they show Rikashi, the demon that's been her disguised as her husband in the mirror. Oh,
no.
Creepy.
No.
No, Amanda does not like that.
No, I was just thinking about like the idea of that, like when it was revealed and she's like, oh no, that was wrong. I shouldn't have done any of that stuff. I can't take it back. But
yeah.
It made me the whole ending of the movie actually made me think of Prince of Darkness, the John Carpenter film.
Yeah.
And I was so worried that that's where it was leading, where like they were going to crash the mirror. She was just going to be stuck in the other dimension, mm-hmm. you know? But I like how he's able to enter the world through like the use of mirror against mirror sort of. And it like the reflection of itself creates like a fissure where he can get into the other side and help her out. And not to be too spoilery, but it was pretty amazing.
Yeah. I like this and this will come up, you know, and I was also thinking about Prince of Darkness and one other film that I'm saving for my double feature pick, that has to do with the relationship between science and magic or the occult. They're mm-hmm. using science to either conjure the devil or a demon or trying to defeat it. I like movies like that. So I think that's kind of where, when Carol O'Connor came in initially with his like red laser thing, I don't know what that was. Like it sounded like, he's got a red laser. It's pointing it. It's doing a pointing thing. It's like the prototype for the cat laser, the laser I used to play with my cat. I don't know.
He's doing it with Rikashi. You know?
And, his pet. Yeah.
So like when he first showed up, I was like, oh, is this gonna like this laser gonna come into play later on to go into the mirror to kill the demon or something? But then we spoil movies, so it's fine. It turns out Carol O'Connor is involved with this whole sect of people who are raising Rikashi or summoning Rikashi.
This quest for cosmic power.
Yes. We all want it. We all want cosmic power.
I mean, I'm not going to blame Miles and the demonologists here, like in this. Like, they're fascinated with magic and occult, as Dr. Sorrell is,
yeah.
and Snowden. I just think they take it. I mean, I'm not going to say they're better at it because they are. They are better at it. They're doing exactly, they're hitting the end goal, like, you know, what they sought out to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, there's an interesting scene where Dr. Sorrell takes the Ingrid character and shows Paul's body. And he's like, you know, y'all are responsible for this. And I'm like, I don't feel that they're responsible for Paul's death. They invited him. He kind of treated it as a night of entertainment, you know, these fools, I forgot what the quote was, some foolish event. And they did what they sought out to do. And I'm like, respect, guys.
Yeah.
I feel like they're the most well-rounded characters. No pun to Carol O'Connor.
Yeah.
But I felt for Paul because he did kind of stumble onto his own demise, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know that he did invite it. And it made me sad because of the Linda Day George character.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And I really liked Ingrid because it showed this kind of like yin yang of the demonologist, because you got Carol O'Connor who's like, yeah, let's really do this and like see where it takes us. And then I think we have characters like Ingrid who are like, I'm curious about what's out there, but also I recognize that it's dangerous and we did something dangerous, mm-hmm. because she comes to help Sorrell at the end, basically. But like, and I like that idea of showing like the two sides of it. Like, so that's not to like absolve her of what happened, But I think it's also like, it's okay to be curious about these things. You know what I mean? It's just where you take it morally, right. I guess you have to consider.
Yeah. There's always that leader that takes it too far and you're kind of like a bystander wanting to know where it goes, but right. you're kind of tied into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amanda, what other thoughts about Fear No Evil do you have that you want to share?
Well, you guys kind of hit the high points. I mean, those are all the great moments of it. But I did want to talk about like that we've been talking a little bit about movies made for women mm-hmm. and stuff. And this is a really interesting film because half of it is Linda Day George's story. And it does focus on her and this idea of grief and loss and overcoming that. And I guess you could see it sort of as a metaphor, like the journey she goes on of learning to let go. Mm-hmm. And a lot of horror movies that were made for television have this aspect to it. And I like, so there's so many of these movies where I think sometimes we're like, well, they're not all made for the women. Look at Kolchak or whatever, you know, and it's like, but then look at The House on Green Apple Road or look at this movie. And I like the idea of like giving the women her space and also making it kind of a sad film. Like I find the ending really touching where he's like, you're not going to remember this and you're going to go on and there will be a wedding one day for you. But she's had to overcome like this really horrible thing that happened to her. And so it ends up like, it's a horror movie clearly, but like it also has a poignancy to it. And I think some of the best horror movies that I can think of that personally I am drawn to are movies that deal with grief and loss, like The Toolbox Murders or like Prom Night. Like, I don't think people sit and watch those and instantly think that those what those movies are about, mm-hmm. but there's that subtext there. And this movie is doing the exact same thing. And I really appreciate this idea of not letting go of the fact that she actually did lose somebody she loved. And also to a degree, I don't have sympathy for the mother, but she was clearly something. She did not like the girl and mm-hmm. she couldn't figure out how to come to terms with Paul's death, except to blame the fiance, right. which drove her to her own form of madness because it's sort of this repressed grief. Instead of exercising the loss and the grief, it comes out as madness, right? And she's a really good example of that. And she's great in the part because she does play the character really well, where like, you're kind of like, I'm pretty sure she's behind some, and it turns out she's not even really behind any of it. It just was lucky that this thing happened with the Carol O'Connor character, that she could tie it in and maybe destroy Linda Day George because of it. She walks that fine line where like you question where she fits into the mystery, but there's a part of me at least that wants to kind of like her and think yeah. that maybe she wants to bond with the woman because that's all that's left of Paul, you know? So I think she's a really interesting character and really, really well written.
Yeah. I agree with that too. I really loved that character, Mrs. Varney. When the movie ended, I kind of immediately thought, well, what happened to Mrs. Varney? You know, yeah. Is she going to go conjure up Rakash? Is she going to figure out all this stuff to try and get her son back in some way? But yeah, I loved her character.
Yeah, same. Let's see. Anything else you want to add? I know you love melodrama, Lance. So, I mean.
Well, yeah. I mean, I did love, like I said, I feel like some of the development, when you take a step back, the characters are very interesting. And you know, alone, when you look at each character individually. But like the relationship between Paul and Barbara, I loved their moments when they're mm-hmm. together, you know, just kind of being adorable and newlyweds, and they're very in love. But I did, when I listened to the commentary, Gary had mentioned a scene that was cut, and it was after the car wreck, an ambulance shows up, and then Barbara gives Paul a blood transfusion to, right. you know, in an effort to revive him and bring him back to life. And I feel like that would have been a nice touch, especially when you bring in the whole Rakashi slowly draining Barbara's life, like the vampirism yeah. stuff, like the cut blood transfusion scene would have proved more effective for that little story, that little piece of information. And I think it would have made their bond stronger for me personally. Mm-hmm. While I do love, you know, the love scenes and them being just adorable together, I wanted something more with their relationship to develop. So I felt, I don't know, more invested in the love in the mirror and stuff.
Yeah.
I think it does work, but when I heard of that cut scene, I was like, oh man, that would have been something cool to see.
Yeah.
I can see. I agree.
Any other thoughts, Amanda, you want to share before we move on to double features?
No, I think you guys covered most of it. I mean, this is this really tremendous movie. I do want to say just briefly that, mm-hmm. so the, before the ABC Movie of the Week, which I think was 1969, just a few months after this aired, kind of changed the face of the made-for-TV movie in that they were producing one a week. And then all the networks started jumping in on it because they were doing so well. The birth of the made-for-TV movie in 1964, up until about 1999, there weren't nearly as many TV movies produced as we saw in the 70s. But they're totally different. And they're really interesting. And they're a little bit more filmic, I think, because they took longer with them and they weren't making as many. And most of them weren't horror. This is one of the first. I think there's a couple that predate it. And there's one whose name I can't even remember now from a couple years before, I think with Martin Landau. Mm. And, but this was one of the first. And they did a really good job with it because I think they took a look at the demographics and they figured out how to do it. They also went deeply into horror instead of just pussyfooting around it, which is what Daughter of the Mind did, which came out around the same time. That's an ABC Movie of the Week. And they did a really good job with kind of creating a blueprint that I think a lot of the supernatural TV movies would follow afterwards. But if people are interested in, if they see this movie and they're kind of taken with it, I would suggest instead of going forward with the history of the made-for-TV movie, I mean starting with the ABC Movie of the Week, even though there's a lot of great stuff in there, maybe try going backwards and trying to find some of the TV movies between 64 and 69 because they're so different. And I've just recently, I've become really enchanted by them. And I wish I could access more of them because I feel like that there's just so much gold there. But that I think I just wanted to mention that this was like a totally different beast than what would come later. No, so to speak, right? No pun intended.
Yeah. No, I feel that absolutely, especially, you know, watching this and then doing a binge of other movies that were mostly from the 70s. There's definitely a different feel to this. This is one of the better looking films that I watch, not just like cinematography wise, but it's shot in Technicolor and has these exaggerated colors. The film looks fantastic. Not to say anything, I mean, a lot of the films that I watched or TV films that I watched were recorded off TV and uploaded to YouTube. So you can't really tell what's happening with them, but this film looks great. Folks, I think Kino is probably having a sale coming up soon. So you get two movies for the price of one, essentially, if you want to make that investment, just saying. We'll put a link in show notes if you do want to pick it up. All right. So let's move on to double features. Amanda, you're our guest. What movie would you double with Fear No Evil?
This is so funny because you pretty much recommended every movie I had on my list. Yeah. So, and I did mention Daughter of the Mind, which I think is really good, but I'm going to go ahead and go with another good 60s movie that you can watch on YouTube. And I wish there was a better print of it because it's stunning. It's called Honeymoon with a Stranger. Mm-hmm. It stars Janet Leigh. So it's based off a play. And I think it's called Trap for a Lonely Man. So they changed the gender of this, speaking of keeping with women aged 18 to 49. And Jenna Lee plays a newly married woman who marries this really rich guy. And they go to this villa he has in Spain. And they go to Spain. It was shot in Spain. And he's like, I'm going to go to the store because we're out of food, like the night after they get there. And he never comes back. And so she goes to the police and Rosanna Brazzi plays the cop that she's dealing with. And he's, if you like Robert Forster, you'll like Rosanna Brazzi in this. He's oozing Robert Forster off of every frame and it's amazing. And she's like, he's gone and I don't know what to do. And then he gets this phone call and they're like, no, your husband's coming back. He'll be back tonight. And so she goes home and this guy shows up and he's like, hey, it's so good to see you, honey. And it's not her husband.
Oh.
And she can't get anybody to believe that it's not. And so all this stuff starts unfolding in front of her. And it's got this amazing cast. It's got Eric Braeden, who most people know as Victor Newman from Young and the Restless. It's got Barbara Steele playing the missing man's sister. It's got Cesare De Nova playing the imposter. Janet Leigh, Rosanna Brazzi. It's shot in Spain. It's amazing. And I actually just wrote an article on it for the Fangoria website where... Oh. Because it's one of those movies I keep returning to, and it's what got me interested in these movies from the 60s. It's just really grand in scope, and it's beautiful. And Janet Leigh is amazing in it. And so that would be my recommendation.
Love it. Watch listed immediately. Is your article on it for Fango already published?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, it's online. It went up like a month ago. I was trying to pitch a TV movie article every month to them, but I don't have the time.
Yeah.
But I was hoping to concentrate on this era if I could.
Excellent. Okay. We'll put a link to that in show notes for folks. Lance, what about you?
Okay, so I thought of a past pick at first while I was watching this, which was Dream Stalker, the shot on video horror directed by Christopher Mills.
Yeah.
I thought that would work, you know, with dead Ricky coming back, haunting his fiance after his hilarious motorcycle crash.
Yeah.
But I decided to really focus in more on the haunted mirror aspect. And I'm going with, it's not a made for TV movie. I should have selected one, but Uli Lamel's The Boogeyman from 1980. Oh,
so good.
Nice. Yeah. We've talked about this film in past episode. We covered an Uli Lamel film, but it's about a young woman played by Susanna Love, who as a child witnesses her young brother stab one of her mother's boyfriends to death. And she watches this murder occur through the reflection of a mirror. So the mirror is essentially haunting her and her family as kind of the murdered man is stuck in this mirror trying to get revenge for his death. So there's a lot of shards of mirror in the movie. There's breaking of mirrors. It also has a psychiatrist in it. A terrible That's one true. Though.
Yeah. Oh, it's John Carradine.
Yeah, John Carradine. He's not nearly as helpful and heroic as Dr. Sorrell, but I think pairing these together, the Boogeyman would add that layer of sleaze and gore that some might be wanting from their horror if watching Fear No Evil. So pairing these would make a good satisfying supernatural double feature.
I think so too. I didn't even think of that. I love that movie. It's so amazing.
Me too. What about you, Erica?
So yeah, originally I was thinking, well, Prince of Darkness could work here. Then I kind of moved on to, well, let's do a Linda Day George TV movie double feature, like She Cried Murder or something like that. But then I was talking to John about it, and I really wanted to focus in on that science or technology versus conjuring a demon or something like that aspect of the film. And I'm also not doing a TV movie, but we've thrown out tons of recommendations, folks. So it's not like you're wanting for any recs here tonight. And it's also good that we do a podcast, because otherwise I would get tomatoes thrown at me for this pick, I'm sure. Hellraiser 4, Bloodline from 1996.
Wow.
An Alan Smithy movie that uses science and technology to conjure a demon. This is a movie for which I am an apologist. I when it comes to ranking the Hellraiser movies, this comes in third place for me. So I know it's not great, but this is one of those movies where I'm like, the ancestor is using mirrors to conjure the demon up and then ultimately destroy him. So there's that aspect. I know this is a stretch. Oh, do you? Okay, good.
I do.
I don't have to apologize to you then. All right. But it's just one of those things where I'm like, you know what? This would be such a weird, people would walk out scratching their heads and they would clearly love Fear No Evil more. Cause I know I'm one of the few people that apologizes for Bloodline. So yeah, that's my pick.
That's a good one.
Okay.
Well done, Erica.
I appreciate you for that, Lance. Okay. So Lance, next movie, what are we doing?
Okay. So we're actually going to stay in the year 1969 with my pick.
Oh, okay.
But we're heading to Denmark.
I've never been.
Oh, well, this is going to take you there. The Man Who Thought Life. It's directed by Jens Raven. It's a Danish sci-fi thriller, probably a little more thriller than horror, but it does have a lot of unsettling moments. We'll obviously talk about it. It's about a man named Steinmetz who has this ability to will physical things into existence just by concentrating and thinking about these items. And it's not just inanimate objects that he can create, but living animals and life forms.
Oh.
But there's one problem for Steinmetz, at least, is that these objects, they disappear after a few hours. They don't last forever. So he approaches this well-known brain surgeon to operate on the area of his brain to correct this problem. The surgeon refuses. He wants nothing to do with this very strange ability. And Steinmetz basically threatens him to change his mind, using his short-lived power that he has. So, intriguing storyline. Some might say that the film's a little slow, but it's shot and framed beautifully. It's black and white. The cinematography is it's gorgeous. I think a lot of people will enjoy watching it. It's very thought-provoking. The script, it's something that I think we'll have fun talking about.
Okay.
It currently has 230 views on Letterboxd, and it's on YouTube with subtitles. The Man Who Thought Life.
I'm excited for that. I've never heard of this. Completely off my radar.
Yeah.
Love it when you surprise me, Lance. So if you are not already, you can follow this podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd at Hex Massacre.
I'm on Letterboxd and Instagram at El Shivey.
Amanda, I tried my best to come up with a list of all of the commentaries and essays that you have done, and it's just, it's too much. But
I don't even know what I've done, to be honest with you. So
I do want to highlight a few for folks. I want to mention some Arrow commentaries you've done that have been really just fantastic highlights for me. Last House on the Left, Initiation of Sarah, Phantom of the Mall, your Scream Factory one for The Spell, Vinegar Syndrome, Don't Open Till Christmas, which you actually just recently did an episode on your podcast for, kind of an offshoot away from like the TV movies. Nightmare in Baddam County, I mentioned that earlier. Multiple commentaries for episodes of Night Gallery, the Kino Lorber releases. And then you've got a huge one coming up, this stacked with contributors, Second Sight release of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Insane. Anything else that you have coming up that you want to plug, or anything else that's come out recently besides the Fangoria article that you mentioned?
I'm not sure. So thank you for mentioning all that and saying you enjoyed them. That means a lot to me, because I put these out there and who knows, you know, what people are listening to and if they, whatever, if they even pay attention. But so I appreciate that.
Of course.
I think the Texas Chainsaw Massacre thing is the big thing that's going on right now. I guess what I'll do here is I'll go ahead and plug my own podcast because I'm in the midst of trying to move it over to a new server and get it out to a larger audience. It's called The Made for TV Mayhem Show. And we basically do two TV movies. Sometimes we veer off of that, but essentially we pick, like I pick a double and then I have usually two partners, sometimes just one. And that's my friend Dan Budnick is with me on every episode. And sometimes our friend Nathan Johnson. Now Dan Budnick has his own podcast called Eventually Super Train. And then Nate, of course, is from The Story Continues. And we do all kinds of movies. We started doing genre movies, but then we just started branching out because there's just so many cool films to talk about. Right now, the podcast is in limbo because I'm trying to move it over. But if you go on Twitter, I think it's just TV Mayhem Podcast, maybe is the connector there. And then on Facebook, it's the Made for TV Mayhem Show. And I think on Instagram, it's Made for TV Mayhem. And then you can follow me on there or on my own Twitter, which I think is also Made for TV Mayhem. I haven't looked. I'm sorry. I'm not prepared for this.
Oh, no, you're fine. I'll put links to all of this in show notes so people can easily follow you and find your podcast. Yeah.
Because I can never remember all the handles and stuff. But, and I can't think of anything that's been announced that I can say that I'm working on. But there's a lot of good stuff, hopefully, that's coming up in the next couple months. So you can just follow me on that social media and I'll announce it there.
Sounds good. We'll also put a link in show notes for anyone who does not have Amanda's book yet, where you can buy that. Amanda, thank you so much for coming on. This has been so much fun, extremely enlightening, an amazing conversation. Thank you so much.
Yes. Oh, no, thank you. That was so much fun for me. I love talking about TV movies, so I hope I didn't overdo it, but I get going. It's the coffee.
No, you're fine. No, not at all. I mean, our listeners love getting huge lists of recommendations, and we have some people who are like, yeah, I've been looking forward to this because they really want to dive into TV movies, but maybe don't know where to start or what recommendations are. Because, you know, there's a list on Letterboxd that has all of the movies that are in the book on there, but it's like, well, where do I start? What's going to work for me? And I think this is a good starting point.
Fantasies. Start at Fantasies. I love that one.
There you go.
One of my all-time favorites. Yeah, it's so amazing. I think everybody should watch that movie like 10 times.
Yeah. When Eric has, you know, said that, you know, you were coming on the podcast, I'm very happy with Fear No Evil, but at first I thought, oh, please say it's for Fantasies.
I mean, there could have literally been anything.
I know. Everybody should get this book. I mean, it's the best. Are you in the house alone?
Thank you.
So pick it up for reference.
I mean, really, I picked it because I'm like, Linda Day George, I want her to be my most watched actor this year. This is my excuse.
And Louis Jordan. I mean, you can't go wrong.
I mean, you can't. Even when he's in a James Bond movie. Which
there's nothing wrong with Bond movies. I'm going to convert you.
Not going to happen. All right. Thanks once again, Amanda, for joining us. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you next episode. I already forgot the name of it.
The Man Who Thought Life.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I'm a bad co-host. All right.
You'll remember it when you watch it.
I will. All right, y'all.
Bye. Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest of them all? And in the mirror, I can see your pretty face. No!
Hey, it's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about a thousand cats would look like?
It's called Night of a Thousand Cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video!
Woo!